This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
These days, football is for every man and woman, of every class, of every background, every race and religion. There are over 2 million adults playing football at least once a week, making it Britain's most popular participation sport. This game has the power to bring people together. But as we continue to discover through this series, it also had the power to keep them apart.
Sport and the British. The Corinthian ideal.
In mid-Victorian England, passing was for the privileged, scoring for the superior. Lots of working class people took up sport for recreational purposes. They played for the love of the game too. But they were not, and never could have been, Corinthians. I've come to the training ground of Corinthian Casuals, which is just off the A3 between London and Guildford, near the Tolworth Junction. And there are about 20 players training tonight under a full moon. It's chilly, they're practicing with a goalkeeper who's diving for saves at the moment as the ball is thrown at him. Last week we discovered how the public schools of England used sport to mould and shape those who would become the ruling elite. Today we're looking at the role sport played for those boys once they became men. The Football Association was founded by these gentlemen in 1863 so that they could have one set of rules and could play each other. Association football in the 1860s, particularly in the south of England, was dominated by upper and middle class men, while later in the north it started to become popular with working class men, and the first professional teams were formed. But during the first decade of the FA's governance, there was no question of players being paid. C.B. Fry was one of the late Victorian era's leading amateur sportsmen.
When I first remember football, the great teams were the old boy teams, old Carthusians, old Etonians, old Westminsters, old Harrovians, and the Royal Engineers. It was much rougher when the posh old boys were playing. You know, there was a very famous man who played for the old Etonians called the Honourable Arthur Kinnaird. He was afterwards Lord Kinnaird and chairman of Barclays Bank.
And Lord Kinnaird was the captain of the old Etonians when they beat Blackburn Rovers, a professional side, in the FA Cup final of 1882. It was the last time an amateur side would win the cup. In that same year, in an attempt to keep professionalism and commercialism in its place, Nicholas Lane Jackson, known as Par Jackson, set up the Corinthians Football Club. Dr. Dill Porter from De Montfort University.
The Corinthians were founded mainly because Par Jackson and some of his associates in London clubland were despondent, really, at the performance of England against Scotland in the first 10 years of England-Scotland internationals after the first one in 1872. Scotland were totally dominant in those games, and I think the ones that particularly counted as far as Jackson was concerned and the ones that made him very depressed were England losing 6-1 at home to Scotland in 1881 and then 5-1 away at Hampden Park the following year. He thought the reason for this was that the Scottish team was largely made up of people that played for the famous Scottish amateur club Queen's Park, who were totally dominant really in Scottish football in the 1860s and 70s, and this gave them the opportunity to play together frequently. And he thought if he could bring the best of English gentlemen amateur footballers together in a club side so that they could play together more frequently, like Queen's Park, they would stand a better chance in these games against Scotland.
For over 20 years, Corinthians held their own against the professional sides, their blend of southern gentlemen taking on the rapidly expanding club sides in friendly matches.
For a long time, they did more than hold their own. In the middle of the 1880s, when Blackburn Rovers were the FA Cup holders, the Corinthians went up to Blackburn to play in December 1884 and beat them 8-1. And this result so surprised people in the northwest of England that it was said that they had to wait for confirmation from people coming back from the match before they'd actually believed the scores that appeared in their local papers. They went up to Preston at the end of the 1880s and played Soudell's Preston North End, best side of its time. And they beat them 5-0. And there are other instances of them recording spectacular victories that go on really till the early 1900s.
I've come inside to the clubhouse and there are pictures adorning the walls of the teams through the years and the more recent sides and the tours that they've been on to Russia, to Japan, to South Africa. The Corinthians avoided league and cup competitions, so it's quite hard to make accurate comparisons, but it seems that they were good enough to sustain their belief that the gentleman amateur was as good or better than the paid professional, and that class would out. They were certainly bigger and better fed than their professional counterparts. In 1894, and there's a plaque over here commemorating it, all 11 of the England side selected to play Wales at Wrexham were Corinthians, and England won that match 5-1. One factor worth bearing in mind is that Parr Jackson was on the selection committee. More than their prowess with the ball, their physical strength, or their speed, they had a moral code, a way of playing that was summed up as the Corinthian spirit by Parr Jackson in his autobiography.
He is one who has not merely braced his muscles and developed his endurance by the exercise of some great sport, but has, in the pursuit of that exercise, learnt to control his anger, to be considerate to his fellow men, to take no mean advantage, to resent as dishonour the very suspicion of trickery, to bear aloft a cheerful countenance under disappointment, and never to own himself defeated until the last breath is out of his body.
A good example of the Corinthian sporting code was their complete opposition to the penalty. Deliberate fouls used to prevent a clear shot at goal had started to spread, and to cope with that abuse of the rules, the penalty kick was introduced in 1891. The Corinthians were appalled because a gentleman would never commit a deliberate foul. That would be cheating. If the referee awarded them a penalty, the Corinthians would steadfastly refuse to take it, and instead they'd merely tap the ball towards the opposing goalkeeper. I asked the coach of this current Corinthians casual side whether they still do that, and he said, "Oh no, we take penalties, just very badly." The former president of the MCC, Doug Insull, said that even 60 years after it was founded, playing football for the Corinthians was always an unusual experience.
If you got a penalty which you thought wasn't justified, kick it wide, you know. That was the sort of mentality of the old guys who were running the club. Yes, we wanted to win very, very much indeed. But we weren't going to be competitive at such a level that people were going to get kicked up in the air or other people injured. But it wasn't shit or bust, do or die. It was, you know, lovely to see you again. Let's go and have a game of football. And it's difficult to say that without sounding very pompous and very non-competitive, neither of which I hope we were.
And looking at this picture from 1905, the team are all on the goal line and at least half of them have got their hands in their pockets. They're sort of looking deliberately nonchalant, like this really doesn't matter. We can do this without even sweating. C.B. Fry would have known these men. He wasn't in the team by now, but he would have certainly played with them. He was the ultimate Corinthian, a polymath who could turn his hand to writing or politics, academia, cricket and football.
Look here, I played for Southampton and we were top of the Southern League 2 years running and we got into the final of the English Cup 1 year. And we played Sheffield United in the final. We played them one Saturday and drew. We played them a fortnight afterwards and drew, played extra time, and they beat us by one goal. That was Saturday. And on the Monday, I played against Sally for old WG and made 77.
Now, when Fry says he played for old WG, he means WG Grace. There was an innate snobbery and hypocrisy about the way in which the gentleman amateur, like WG, played sport, because they believed that the gentleman amateur was naturally gifted and supposedly shone because he had innate talent, whereas the poor working-class professional had to grind at the game, train harder and try harder. This supremacy was bred into them, and it was untainted by the lure of money. But their moral superiority didn't stop them from touting for work on the field of play, as Doug Insull remembers.
We had a centre-half played for us quite a bit, called Bill Slack, who became Sir William Slack and the Queen's physician. We used to wear long shorts and shirts with breast pockets, and it was often said about Bill that he used to go down and he'd stand over and say, "I'm terribly sorry, old boy, but if I can be of any help," and drew his card out of his top pocket, just in case he wanted to come and see him for treatment.
The FA had legalised professionalism in 1885, 10 years before rugby split in two over the same problem. They did so with the objective of controlling it. But there was tension between the gentlemen amateurs and their paid counterparts. Parr Jackson wrote in his memoirs that the game was being eroded, that it had been altered by spectators to suit spectators. He advocated that the FA be split into two divisions, one for amateurs and the other for professionals. Dil Porter.
In 1907, the separate association which Jackson had envisaged did come about when the Corinthians, the universities and the major old boys' clubs formed their separate amateur football association. They were irritated by the increasing influence of professionalism and commercialism at the FA, and they decided to leave and set up on their own. It didn't last long. They were back in the fold by 1914. The reasons it didn't last long? Well, firstly, the FA by that time was far too powerful. It was clearly unchallengeable, really, as the governing body of football in England. Secondly, the old boys associations found that the amateur working class clubs didn't want to follow them into exile from the FA. There was no reason for them to do so. And thirdly, they discovered quickly they shot themselves in the foot. They lost their attractive fixtures against professional clubs. And by 1914, it's actually the Corinthians and the universities that are leading the charge back to the FA.
Above the bar here in the club room, there are a series of five team photographs, all of them on tour. And David Harrison has been a member of this club for how many years now?
Well, I first played in 1953.
Do you think, David, that the Corinthian spirit still exists in sport?
Well, yes, of course it does. I mean, we all applaud fair play when we see it. I mean, think of that example of Di Canio when he had the opportunity to score, the goalkeeper was injured, so he picked the ball up and the crowd applauded. Of course it exists, and we hope it exists at our level. We try to do it from time to time. I mean, we've got an example where in a schools match, the team that goes around playing against schools, a penalty was awarded in our favour, a doubtful penalty, and our captain simply rolled the ball to the goalkeeper.
The players training here tonight on this freezing cold evening ply their trade in Ryman Division 1 South, and it's a cutthroat business. Players still shake hands at the start of a match, but arguments with the referee are common. A booking for ungentlemanly conduct still exists too. And it's certainly still regarded as a desirable aim, but it's rarely achieved in top-flight football to be a Corinthian. Who, in the interests of parity, would take a player off their own team if the opposition had one sent off? Football today is high theatre, pantomime even. And at its heart, every club is a business, there to make a profit or to slide into administration. The Corinthians would have been dismayed at such developments, as are many others. But at the same time, taking an unfair advantage over an opponent is still frowned on in sport. Most sportsmen and women, in their local park, at the leisure centre, at the golf club, or training here this evening, know how the game should be played. One doesn't have to be a gentleman in this or any other age to play like one.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.